Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Ladaris Cordell, and our thanks to the Bernard Osher Foundation for supporting today's program. It is my pleasure to introduce Senator Al Franken, best-selling author of Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. It's a great title. Senator Franken is a well-respected member of Congress and has represented his home state of Minnesota since 2009. He has written and introduced legislation to improve healthcare services, increase mental health awareness in schools, help veterans suffering from PTSD, and protect our right to privacy. Prior to politics, Senator Franken spent 37 years as a comedy writer, author, and radio talk show host. He was recruited as one of the first writers and performers on Saturday Night Live and won 3 Emmy Awards. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the giant of the Senate, Al Franken.
Wow.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Senator, most people who write about their lives, either in memoir or an autobiography, have a story to tell about serious obstacles they've overcome. Physical disabilities, mental illness, racism, sexism. Your burden, your obstacle, was humor.
Yes.
Something that you call the funny. So the funny became a liability early on in your quest for a Senate seat.
Yes.
Why was that?
Well, I'm very proud of my career as a comedy writer and comedian and satirist. What happened was the Republican Party and my opponent, Norm Coleman, put everything I'd ever said or written as a comedian or a satirist and put it through a $15 million machine called the Dehumorizer, and which was built with very sophisticated Israeli technology. And what it would do is very often in satire, I use literary tools like irony or hyperbole or even ambiguity. And sometimes you take those out and you rob everything of the context and it looks horrible at the end. So that was used against me very effectively. So it became a very nasty campaign. My opponent, Norm Coleman, hadn't actually done much in the Senate. And so the campaign really became about making me sort of unacceptable, ironically, now that we have President Trump, that my writing, give you an example. I wrote an article in Playboy for the millennial issue. And it was about, it was basically about virtual sex. And I wrote it, it was a humorous article, meant with a lot of irony. And one of the ironic passages was about what a great learning tool the internet was. And I said that, and it's, if you think about it, it's a very conservative little joke. And the joke is that internet is a great learning tool. My son last year did a great sixth grade report using the internet on bestiality. He downloaded a lot of great visual aids, and the kids in the class just loved them because, you know, at that age, they're just sponges. And the message of the joke is, parents, you might want to monitor what your kid's doing on the internet. But that turned into an ad which included a Al Franken wrote jokes about bestiality. And it was like came from like infinity into your living room through your eyeballs, the back of your skull. And my mother-in-law cried when she saw that. So that was what it was like. So when I finally did get seated, which is actually 8 years ago tomorrow.
That's right.
I basically had to not be funny for a long time. And to show people, the people in Minnesota, that I was serious about the job. And because my comedy career had been, and you can't litigate a joke. You can't explain why the bestiality joke is actually a conservative joke. And you just can't do that in a campaign. So I had to really prove to the people of Minnesota that I was serious about the job, and I was. And so I just I left the funny alone for quite a while.
So it seems.
But I'm back.
Thank goodness.
And I'm back. It's okay now. I got reelected by a very wide margin in 2014. The people of Minnesota kind of got it. So now I can be a workhorse, but a workhorse with a sense of humor.
So is being funny, though, a part of your DNA? I mean, if that's the case, where in the gene pool did the funny come from? And what was it like growing up in the Franken household? Were you a class clown? Or?
Well, not in the Franken household. I was, you know. When I figured out, I became a comedian because my favorite thing in childhood was watching comedy with my parents and my brother. And my dad especially just loved Buddy Hackett. He loved Buddy Hackett. He loved a lot of comedians. But my dad inhaled a pipe all his adult life. And so if my dad would get on a laughing jag, which he always would when Buddy Hackett was on, he would eventually start coughing, and then he'd cough up phlegm. And he had a handkerchief in his right pocket. I always carry a handkerchief in my right pocket. I don't smoke, but and I don't really need it for the same use. But if Johnny Carson said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Buddy Hackett." My mom would leave the room. I wonder if I should tell this joke. Okay. This is a Buddy Hackett joke. Okay, so just, and I haven't told this on the tour yet, but since, I don't know. So, years later, I get on a flight from New York to L.A., and Buddy Hackett's on the flight. So I'm really excited because my dad I love Buddy Hackett, but I go up to him, "Mr. Hackett, my dad just idolized you." And he says to me, guy goes into a doctor's office. He's got a dot on his forehead. Doctor says, "Oh my God, I've never seen that before, but I read about it in medical school." And the guy says, "Well, doc, what is it?" He said, "Okay, well, in 6 weeks, you're going to have a penis growing out of your forehead." So, "Well, doctor, cut it off." He said, "I can't cut it off. It's attached to your brain. You'd die." And the guy said, "So, doctor, what you're telling me is that in 6 weeks, when I get up in the morning and look in the mirror, I'm going to see a penis growing out of my forehead?" The doctor said, No. "You won't see it. The balls will cover your eyes." Now,
ha ha ha.
Now, you can understand why I can't tell that joke. I haven't told that publicly since before my first campaign.
So let's talk about footnotes. So I read your book. I'm chuckling through the whole book, even though it deals with some very serious issues.
Sure, yeah.
Still chuckle through the book, and the footnotes are just awesome. So could you maybe read a footnote or two?
Sure.
There's one on page 2 you might want to look at.
Okay.
There's another
look
on page.
Look at that. Let me see.
Mark there.
Yeah, I know it's right there, but there's one on, yeah, okay. You know, there's also one on page 3 I like. But on page 2, I say, basically I say that one of the reasons I wrote the book is to answer the question I get asked the most, which is being a senator as much fun as working on Saturday Night Live? And, of course, the answer is no. Why would it be? But it's the best job I've ever had because you get to do things to improve people's lives. So, so I talk about how great it is to be a senator. And then so it says, like, which would often prompt the people to ask, are you talking about the same U.S. Senate that is one of the two bodies in today's U.S. Congress? And isn't today's Congress just an unrelenting horror show? The answer is yes. Today's Congress is a polarized, dysfunctional body rendered helpless by partisanship, more focused on scoring short-term political points than on solving our nation's urgent problems. In short, the Washington of the past decade has been awash in nincompoopery. And then I have a superscript above it, USS, okay? And so then, and an asterisk, and the footnote explains, a note on style from the author. Because I'm a U.S. senator, I can't use the word bull, even though Washington is indeed awash in bullshit. So throughout this volume, whenever you see a mild oath like fiddlesticks or some gentle name-calling like numbskull or dimwit or some old-timey synonym for bull but that, like poppycock or flim-flummery, followed by the letters USS in superscript, that means I've replaced something far more plain-spoken with a less offensive phrase or expression. The USS stands for United States Senate, the body in which I now serve. I feel I have a duty to both my colleagues and my constituents to make at least a token effort to preserve its dignity and decorum. I wish I could say the same for that dunderhead, Ted Cruz. And there's the first time I mention Norm Coleman, my opponent, I have a little footnote. I go, don't worry, former Senator Norm Coleman landed on his feet and continues to serve the people of Minnesota as a paid lobbyist for the government of Saudi Arabia. I just like that one because it's mean. Oh, and then I'm talking about when I went to, I wrote Lies and Lying Liars, Who Tell Them a Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, when I was a teaching fellow, or I was a fellow at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard. And I talk about, I thought as a teaching fellow, they said no, but you can have a study group. And I said, well, can I have the study group study how to research my book? And they said, yeah, a lot of professors at Harvard do that. And but then I have an asterisk. In the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you that Harvard did turn down my first proposed topic for my study group, which was how you can build a nuclear weapon in your garage with just $100 worth of supplies from Home Depot. So,
love the footnotes.
So it's
great.
When you read the book, most of the footnotes are
they're hilarious.
Meant to be a joke.
Hilarious.
Oh, but sometimes actually are informing.
So you won your election in 2009 by just 312 votes.
Right.
And then there was their legal challenges dragged on, was it 8 months?
Right? Basically what happened was morning after the election, I was down by 725 votes. And my opponent, Norm Coleman, then Senator Coleman, said that if I were Franken, I'd step back and let the healing begin. Now, in Minnesota, I was down by, I think, 0.02 of a percent at that point. And you can ask for a recount, an automatic recount at 0.5, at a half a percent. So I, of course, was going to go ahead with the recount. And in Minnesota, we have, it's not Florida, we have, you hand recount every ballot, and it's all done with filling in, like, the SAT thing. And we knew that a lot of our voters make more mistakes than their voters tend to be immigrants who haven't taken an SAT or, just people haven't taken SATs. And so some people would circle the thing or put an X through it and the machine might not read it. So we knew that we had a good shot at this. And it got down to 225 right away when you actually do this thing where you canvas, called a canvas, where you reconcile all the numbers and stuff. So we were down to 225, like, soon after. And then we did the recount. The recount ended in time for me to be seated with my colleagues from that class. And that's when Norm Coleman decided to take the anti-healing position. And he stuck with that for quite a while. And so we had what's called an election contest, which is a legal proceeding. You might know about that, Judge. And and then after that, he appealed that to the Minnesota State Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Finally, they decided, every judge, everywhere along the way, it was unanimous. Wow. Per curiam.
So what was your biggest takeaway, though, from that campaign, lesson learned?
Lesson learned was it's really hard to run. In 2008, it was hard to run having done comedy. I mean, that's not much of a broad lesson for anybody, but it's like a lesson for me in retrospect. So it's kind of useless. But I do talk about, because I had never served in public office, and I write a lot about learning these odd things that you learn to do, like pivot. pivoting is not answering a question, is basically what it is. And I could not do that. I would, like, people would ask me a question, ask me a question, and I'd answer it. And I would give a fulsome answer, and instead of pivoting to what I wanted to talk about, that's what you do. So a pivot would be early in the campaign if someone said, you're behind Norm Coleman by 15 percentage points in the polls. How can you convince DFLers, it's the Democratic Farmer Labor Party of Minnesota, DFLers that you're the guy to beat him? And the pivot is, you know, when I go around Minnesota, Minnesotans don't talk about polls. What they talk about is health care and whether they're going to go bankrupt if someone in their family gets really sick or in an accident. They talk about educating their kids. That's a pivot,
speaking
right?
Like a politician.
Yeah, that's what you do. I could not figure. Because I had always been told by my parents and my teachers, answer the question. And it was like an idiot, I would do that. And so the day I finally figured it out, this is what happened. I go to New Ulm, Minnesota. New Ulm's a beautiful town in south central Minnesota. It was founded by Germans. From Ulm, probably, and so it's New Ulm, and I was speaking to a picnic of DFLers, of Democrats in New Ulm, And but there was a tracker there. A tracker is something else you have to learn how to deal with. Trackers that are always there taping you. And I figured out a
from way, the opposition.
Yeah, they're tracking you. So if you say something like, if you tell a baby you're going to raise their taxes, or you knock over an elderly person, they'll have it. You know? and so a tracker's there. And so in New Ulm, they have a statue to Arminius, who is a German, I guess a Hun or something, who defeated the Romans in 9 AD in a battle and killed a lot of Romans. And this is like when Christ was just a little tot. And so they have a statue to him that's a 25-foot statue on a 75-foot foundation pedestal. And so I'm speaking in the shadow of Herman the German. And that's what they call him. They call it Herman the German. That's what you call Arminius there, Herman the German. So I'm from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. St. Louis Park is the Jewish suburb of Minneapolis. By that, it's like 25% Jewish. But that's, in Minnesota, that's a lot of Jews. That's a shtetl in Minnesota. So, and everybody knows St. Louis Park is the Jewish suburb of Minneapolis. So I went right through my head while I'm saying, in the shadow of Herman the German, of saying, like, you know, I grew up in St. Louis Park, and we had a statue there, too, Stu the Jew. And, but I didn't say it. I didn't say it because there was a tracker there. And I didn't want them to go like, Al Franken, blame the Holocaust on the people of New Orleans. You know, I didn't know what they were going to do. So I didn't do it. So then I didn't do it. And I tell my team, I say, I didn't do Stu the Jew. I thought of this. They didn't know Stu the Jew. It was in my head. But they went, good for you. You didn't do that. So then, like a week later, New York Magazine comes into Minnesota to do a story on me running for the Senate. You know, Franken running for Senate, no joke. That's like every headline. And so at one point, the writer says, is there ever a time when you thought of a joke and that you didn't use it? And I go, oh, yeah, Stu the Jew. And of course, the article, you know, starts with Stu the Jew. And my team is going like, why? Hello.
Audience.
Oh, okay. There's new Stu the Jew questions. Anyway, so why the hell did you not pivot or just say, I can't think of one right now. You know, that's pretty easy. And so I realized I've got to learn to pivot. And so then I had been trained to pivot. I had gotten pivot training. And I sat down with, but now I said, I got to learn this. And I got another lesson. And then the next interview I had was with a guy who had interviewed me several times before, a journalist in Minneapolis. He asked me a question and I pivot. And he doesn't seem to mind it at all. So then he asked me the next question, and I pivot. And he doesn't mind at all. Next question, I just say, this is fun. I'm going to just pivot egregiously and see what his reaction is. No reaction whatsoever. I do it three more times. End of the interview. The interview's over. He turns to my press secretary and says, he's getting very good. I think he's got a shot. He's got a real shot. So I learned a lot about, there's stuff in this about the press and about running for office and putting an organization together. So I learned a lot about how to put nuts and bolts of a campaign and how to run. And a lot of it is about, what I really learned running was how great the people of Minnesota are. And what I really learned was, that people cared about health care. This is before the Affordable Care Act, of course. And everywhere I would go in the state, If you went into a cafe, a VFW hall, you would see a flyer up on there about having a burger bash or a spaghetti dinner for a family that had gone bankrupt because someone had gotten sick. And I would go to these bean feeds in Minnesota. The sort of the DFL organizing principle are bean feeds. And you go to these bean feeds, and you'd hear from people about that. And I knew that. I had a radio show on Air America. Elizabeth Warren was a frequent guest of mine. She talked about how half of all bankruptcies are caused by a medical crisis. I knew that intellectually, but it became personal when I toured around Minnesota, because it was personal with the people of Minnesota. So that's why right now, right this minute, healthcare is such a defeating what the Republicans want to do is so crucial.
So, Senator, we know that you are a giant of the Senate because you've told us.
I ask the reader to decide for themselves. Okay.
But do you know?
After you've read it.
Do you know some giants of the Senate, if other than yourself?
I gave a copy to every senator, every other senator, and I said from one giant to another, to every senator except for Ted Cruz. And to Ted, I just wrote, Ted. I've emphasized your negative qualities for humorous effect. I hope you don't mind. Now.
So, one other, there's some real...
And there's reasons for that, believe me.
We're going to get to the thing.
Yeah, okay.
But just one last thing, though, on the impulse control, on the funny. Your staff...
I have impulse control. I was not funny. For a long time.
When it came to writing notes, right, to your constituents.
Yes.
Right? So.
Well, the first one.
Yes.
So you write notes to constituents, you know, for, congratulations on being named to this, on your retirement or whatever. So we had a woman, my first day in office, a woman in Minnesota was turning 110. Ruth Anderson. And so I had never, and so I get this, you write a note to Ruth Anderson on her 110th, for her 110th birthday. So I wrote, dear Ruth, you have a bright future. And my chief of staff gets it and he goes, like, what is this? And I went, it's a joke. It's, I thought she might enjoy it. And he goes, yeah, you think her family's going to enjoy it? You think her grandchildren are going to enjoy it? And I went, oh, yeah, you're right.
So what about your draft of a press release following the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage?
Yes, I do. I want to get it worded right. This is after I won the damn election. After the Coleman, that campaign, they had a dehumanizer. I had to build a dehumanizer myself once I was in the Senate, which was my staff. And so, because I would always come up with stuff that they go, no, you can't do that. So I wanted, after the marriage decision, which was a 5-4 ruling that marriage is a fundamental right for everybody, for same-sex couples. And Justice Scalia just wrote this really unhinged dissent of describing the majority ruling as a judicial putsch. And so I wrote a statement that I wanted our communications office to put out. And it was, Senator Al Franken of Minnesota today applauded the Supreme Court's decision and described Justice Antonin Scalia's dissent as, quote, very gay. And that one was such a fight because I had already been reelected and I was going, come on. It's really funny. And I didn't, I lost. They just were adamant. And I didn't get that. But I got in the book. You know? So there's a lot of those that I, wasn't able to do.
This is the Commonwealth Club. This is the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley.
So it's very, I'm sorry. I apologize then.
I am Ladaris Cordell in conversation with Senator Al Franken.
Oh. I thought you were reprimanding me.
No, not yet. I'll try it again.
Oh, phew. Okay.
And I'm in
You want to say that again?
Sure. Let's do it again. This is the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. I'm Ladaris Cordell in conversation with Senator Al Franken, author of Al Franken, Giant of the Senate.
Okay.
So, Senator, much of your book is consumed with talking about the lying liars in Congress. You don't like them. You don't like liars. And you've already mentioned Ted Cruz before, but you write in your book, Ted is extremely smart.
Yes.
I don't begrudge him that. There are plenty of senators who are smarter than I am. For example, my own senior senator, Amy Klobuchar, or my friend Sheldon Whitehouse, or Lindsey Graham. I like them all because none of them are sociopaths.
Right.
So the question is, what is to be done about all the lying?
Well, Ted is a special case. And I make that very clear. I am very careful in the book when I talk about a private conversation I've had with any other member to observe protocol, which is if you have a private conversation with another member and he or she could look bad because of it, you have to get permission from them to. So I did that with Tom Coburn, for example. And I'll tell about that in a second. But with Ted had violated the protocol so many times and had lied to me personally in a way that I describe. I justify everything I do in Ted. Ted's like an exception to the rule. And so he's like just a toxic coworker. He's like the guy who microwaves fish. In the lunchroom. He's just, so I'll tell the story about, so like Tom Coburn, I like my Republican colleagues, and having a sense of humor, even though I wasn't funny publicly, I was, with the other senators, I was funny, and they understood right away. I had used so much of my humor to heap scorn and ridicule on Republicans that they were wary of me when I came in, but it took like a day for them to figure out, oh, I get it, he's funny, and he likes to laugh. And so, like, Jim DeMint, remember him? He was a very conservative senator from South Carolina, then went on to head the Heritage Foundation. I get sworn in. He comes up to me after I'm sworn in and says, how are things on the far left? And I say, they're great. How are things on the nutcase right? And he laughed. And we had a very friendly relationship based on that. And and a lot of my colleagues are very funny. Lindsey Graham is very funny. When he was like running 15th out of the 17 Republican candidates in the 2016 primaries, I ran into him in the bathroom. I said, Lindsey, if I were voting in the Republican primaries, I'd vote for you. And without hesitation, he said, that's my problem. And So most everyone has a sense of humor. Tom Coburn, really no sense of humor. He was called Dr. No. He's retired. He's Oklahoma. He's called Dr. No for two reasons. He was an obstetrician gynecologist, doctor. And No, because he would put holds on a lot of legislation. And because he was a very extreme federalist. He believed that everything should be done by state government, not the federal government. And so my first three or four interactions with him, we just missed, completely missed. And so I said, I came, went up to him one day, and I said, Tom, can I take you to lunch? And he said, tell you what, take me to breakfast. So I said, okay. So we went to breakfast a couple days later, and we sat down about 8 in the morning. I said, look, let's for the next 40, 45 minutes, whatever it is, let's just have fun, okay? And let's, you know, if we can talk about anything. We can talk about our families. We can talk about politics. We can talk about our careers. But let's just have fun, okay? And he goes like, okay, fun. And I said, okay, careers. Let me ask you something. To be a doctor in Oklahoma, do you have to have any formal education? And he exploded. He goes, yes, you've got to go to medical school. And I said, okay, that was a joke. And that's what I used to do in my career, you see. And so then settled down, and we had a nice time, and I explained what jokes were and what the proper reaction is to jokes. And we had fun. And he wrote me a note saying he had fun. And so then when I'm writing the book, I told you the rule, the protocol. So I call him up. He's retired. He's in Oklahoma. And I call him up and I go, Tom, it's Al Franken. Well, how you doing, Al? And I go, good, good. I'm writing a book. And do you remember that breakfast we had, the first breakfast we had, and the thing about the any formal education? Anyway, yeah, I do. Okay. Well, I would just, you know, I wonder if it'd be okay with you if I use that story in the book. And he said, we have a First Amendment. You can write anything you want. And I went, well, okay, I understand that. I was just trying to be collegial, and well, you're a gentleman, but we have a First Amendment. And if I write a book, I'm going to write anything I want. So he had a less of a sense of humor than my other colleagues.
So let's switch up. Let's do a lightning round.
Okay.
I'm just going to throw out one or two word. Maybe someone or something, and you can give me your quick response.
Okay.
And you can tell an anecdote as long as it's quick and it has to be funny. All right.
Jesus Christ.
So here we go.
Did you do this in your court? Counselor? I'm going to say one word. Okay.
You ready?
Yeah,
all sure. Right. Senator Kamala Harris.
She is already making herself well-known as a prosecutor. She's on the Intelligence Committee, and her questioning is tough, and it upsets Senator McCain.
All right.
See, I got to the funny.
That's good.
I got to the good. Funny pretty
All right.
fast.
Next one.
Okay.
Lobbyist.
Lobbyist. Norm Coleman. No, lobbyists are... I write a lot about fundraising and lobbyists, and what lobbyists basically... Fundraising with lobbyists is they're... Very often, they're not... They're just buying access. They just want access. And that in itself is a little dangerous. But very often, the lobbyists that give me money tend to be giving me money because I have already voted for their interest, their client, and it's usually they're on the same team. So I tend to have lobbyists from from the biofuel industry, because Minnesota, we have a lot of biofuels. You know, when you're a senator from your state. I went to Israel in 2010, and I met with members of the Knesset, and I realized that every member of the Knesset represents all of Israel. No one represents the northern suburbs of Tel Aviv. In the Senate, you represent, there are two senators from Minnesota. So we grow a lot of corn and a lot of soybeans, and I'll have an argument with anyone on the carbon in, carbon out of biofuels, including the land and all that stuff. It's actually very green, and the EPA has said that. And of course, I don't know about this new EPA Commissioner Pruitt, but. So very often at war, like you talked about privacy, I have a lot of privacy people who support me because I created a committee on privacy technology and the law in the Judiciary Committee. So lobbyists, I write a lot about the nuts and bolts of politics and fundraising. And some of it may be a little counterintuitive to you. It'd be great if we had public financing of elections. I totally agree with that. But right now, I'm not unilaterally disarming against my Republican, opponents. And I write in that chapter about, I'd been in the Senate maybe 2 years, and I did an event in Minnesota, which are the awards for the theater in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And a woman said to me, she came up to me and said, I can see through different dimensions, and I can see that there are cracks in your soul. And that's a really disturbing thing to hear about your soul. And she said, you have a good soul, but you've been in Washington and it has put cracks in your soul. And I want your soul to heal and be green. And I said, I'm getting a massage later. And she thought that was good. So I kind of understand her viewpoint. Like, once you're in the institute, it does change you. And Barney Frank once said, I only voted once for someone who agrees with me 100% of the time, and it's when I voted for myself the first time. So I kind of grapple with how, you know, it changes you to be in the institution and you see things differently. And I think that's a valuable thing in the book, in Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. And I'm not saying the or a, I'm just saying giant.
Lightning round, back to it. Let's see. All right, next up, Rachel Maddow.
Important Democrat. Broadcaster. Smart.
Betsy Davis.
Long openings. Long circular openings. That references itself over and over again.
Got it.
Rachel Maddow. You know what I'm talking about? Anyway. Yeah, okay.
All right. Secretary of Education, Betsy Davis.
Oh, man. That was something. Betsy DeVos was... there's some terrible cabinet choices, nominees that were made, and some were terrible for the just different reasons. Tom Price, HHS, partly was so bad because he was a doctor, and he just had the weirdest views on healthcare, and was smart. Pruitt. It couldn't be, it's like a bizarro world choice for EPA because he had sued the EPA so much. DeVos, but he knew stuff about it, I guess, from the lawsuits. But Betsy. Why do I call her? I know it's Beverly D'Angelo. I guess I just wanted Beverly D'Angelo instead of. I think Beverly D'Angelo knows a lot more about education. Betsy DeVos. So Betsy DeVos is, her whole thing about education is she wants to do vouchers. And vouchers is really about taking money from public schools and putting it into private and religious schools. And she has basically said, and her husband has said, they want to do that to build God's kingdom. So to get kids into religious school and out of public school. And so she knew, I'd heard, there are courtesy visits before this is not a short answer, is it?
Oh, go right ahead.
There are courtesy visits before the hearings, before the confirmation hearings, and I'd heard before my visit from other senators that she didn't know a lot about education. So I had her, she came in, and I asked her like one or two questions just to kind of feel around about how much she knew. And me and my staff were going, after like the second question went like, oh my Lord, oh my Lord. And then I just went, okay, I'm not going to talk to her. I'm not going to ask her anything else. And we just talked about our families and stuff. And I just wanted to think about what's the question I can ask her that's fair. It isn't a gotcha question. And I came down to growth versus proficiency, which anybody in education in the United States, any teacher, knows growth versus proficiency. And it's a very important way in which you measure whether teachers are succeeding, whether schools are succeeding. And proficiency is you create an arbitrary line of proficiency and you see how many kids are above it. And that's how you're judged. And the result of that is perverse because teachers just teach the kids just above and just below proficiency. Growth is you measure how much each kid grows. Because when you're just race, it was called the race to the middle. That's what it's called. When teachers just constantly, because this kid, no matter what you do to that kid ain't going to fall below proficiency. This kid, the kid that year isn't going to get the proficiency. So you just focus on those kids. The only thing I liked about No Child Left Behind was the damn name. And growth is you measure each kid, how much they grew that year. And a sixth grade teacher who takes a kid from a second grade level of reading to a fourth grade level of reading is a hero. And so you can, this is just, you can see what an emotional issue this is with teachers, with school boards, with superintendents, with principals. Everyone in Minnesota wanted growth, proficiency, and at first, No Child Left Behind said only proficiency. And your school will be measured only by what percentage of kids are above proficiency, which is just terrible. So I asked her that, and she just, it was the deer in the headlights and tumbleweeds at the same time. And it was just a spectacularly embarrassing moment in history. It really... And there were a number of them in her hearing. There were a number of them in her hearing. So I'm sorry that I didn't do that very well.
You did it fine. We're just going to stop in the middle of the lightning round. We're going to go right to audience questions.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry about
that's
that.
That's perfect.
Lightning round question on Beverly DeVos.
You know.
Wow, was that bad? I apologize.
All right, here we go. Audience question. What is your favorite Grateful Dead song? We're gonna get there. We're really gonna get there.
That okay. Is my favorite Dead health song. Just can we talk about healthcare in this country? They only played it once. It was in Montecito in '67. So, but I've got a tape of it, and it's not good. That's why they stopped playing it. I think, you know, I love the Dead, and there's just, I have a whole bunch of favorite songs. Jack Straw, Althea, Bertha, I just, it just would go on and on. I just love the Dead. And the thing about a debt isn't a song. It's about a concert. It's about, there's nothing like a Grateful Dead concert.
According to a Terry Gross interview, you said that your Republican colleagues are scared to cross Trump. What do you think about that?
Well, Trump, his base is their base. I mean, it's a conservative Republican base, basically. And so until his base abandons Trump, Republicans are afraid to abandon Trump because they'll get punished. Most Republicans in the Senate basically fear getting primaried from the right. And I think they feel like if they abandoned Trump, that's what will happen to them. Most of them are in very red states, or in quite red states, and they feel like it's more likely them to lose. And they know the Koch brothers will go after them. The Koch brothers aren't big fans of Trump, but if you lose the base, that very, very conservative base, then you're in trouble. And the Koch brothers have that have a little bit different overlap of that base, but because of Citizens United, they can put $10, $20, $30 million behind you like that, and you know, so that's why I think, and we'll see if the base sticks with them. And the base has we unfortunately in this country have very different universes of where we get our information. This is why I wrote Rush Limbaugh as a big fat idiot and other observations, because of radio, right-wing radio. And then I wrote Lies and Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. And both those books are about lying. Rush was also about Newt Gingrich and the coarsening of our civil discourse. This has led to Trump, to what we have right now. It's almost adorable that I could write books that about people lying and people would buy them and go like, wow, they really lie. And and now it's like you don't pay a price at all for lying. It helped Trump, I think. I think his supporters went like, it's more entertaining, you know. It's like a movie based on a true story, but it's more interesting with some lies in it. And I don't think he pays any price for it. And also, so I was writing about right-wing talk radio, about Fox News, then you have the internet, and you have, and so people can get their information from whatever confirms their own bias. So there is a strong base that I don't know if Trump will ever lose, no matter what happens to him.
Can you please tell us where you think the Democratic Party is going? It appears to be sailing along rudderless in the biggest undermining of America's social and economic history.
I understand that critique. I don't think it's true. I know my colleagues in the Senate, I know the frustration with us. We're not very good at messaging. I say in the book that our bumper stickers always end with continued on next bumper sticker. In my book, I start off basically saying why I'm a Democrat. That's my first chapter. And I'm a Democrat because I grew up in Minnesota, in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, and my dad didn't graduate high school. He was a printing salesman. We grew up in a two-bedroom, one-bath house. I felt like the luckiest kid in the world because I was. I was growing up middle class, at the height of the middle class, in America, in Minnesota, in St. Louis Park. I thought I could do anything. And I think that people don't feel like that anymore, and for very good reason. And I think that's why we lost this election, because there's so many people angry about 40 years of that. My wife, who I met my freshman year of college, she grew up very differently. She, her father, a World War II, decorated World War II vet, died in a car accident when she was 18 months old. She had a 3-month-old sister then, and 3 older siblings. And her mom was 29 years old and widowed with 5 kids. And she had a high school education. And they barely made it. They made it because of Social Security survivor benefits. Sometimes they were hungry. Sometimes they turned the heat off in the winter. This is Portland, Maine. But they made it. And every one of the girls in the family, the 4 girls, went to college. And they went to college on combinations of scholarships and Pell Grants. And at that time, a full Pell Grant paid 80% of a public college education. Today it pays about 35%. And I know kids, one of the big issues in my first campaign was the affordability of college, and it still continues. And we fight on that, but we're not in the majority. And that's a lot to do with the states, how much the states kick in on public education. They made it when Bootsy went to high school. My mother-in-law got a GI loan, $300 to go to college. And she got 3 more loans, graduated from college, became a school teacher, grade school teacher, and because she taught Title I kids, poor kids, she had all her loans forgiven. My brother-in-law went in the Coast Guard. Every member of that family became a contributing member of our society, middle class. That's why I'm a Democrat. You know, they tell you in this country you have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. First, you have to have the boots. And the government gave my wife's family the boots. And that's why I'm a Democrat. Paul Wellstone said, we all do better when we all do better. And that is true. We're strongest when there's a strong middle class. And you can see, what is this health care bill about? What is this health care bill about?
And that's our
it's about question. A tax cut for the wealthiest Americans and taking the people who need it the least and taking health care away from the people who need it the most. And if that doesn't, that should be telling the Trump base that he isn't looking out for them at all and that he was lying when he said, I'm not going to cut Medicaid.
Question, will you consider running for president? And if you do, who would be your running mate? And is this country ready for a Jewish president?
I'm not going to run for president. But if I did, I'd want a balanced ticket, so I'm a Reformed Jew. I'd pick an Orthodox Jew.
Is it realistic to hope that moderate Republicans will work with Democrats on things like health care and tax reform?
Yeah, it is. And we should have been working on this. I don't know what happens if and when this falls apart, when they come back, and we're coming back Monday. So we'll find out, I hope. We should be working on strengthening the Affordable Care Act. We should be working on strengthening what works and shoring up what's not working. The exchanges have spiked in costs, and it's insidious. The Republicans have done everything they can to undermine the exchanges, from you know, to state officials not helping people sign up, to getting rid of the risk corridors, and I don't want to get real weedy here, but the risk corridors were part of if an insurance company got a risk pool that was worse than actuarially had been anticipated, they had paid in to a fund and they would get money back to protect the these insurance companies. And when that got taken away, then insurance companies left the exchanges, and because there was less competition, I see a woman nodding here, and I think she must be in healthcare in some way. Yes. Okay. So if you know about this stuff, you know how insidious the undermining, and you have to have a mandate. You do. You have to have a mandate, because the whole point, and I write a whole chapter about how we did ACA. And look, when I was running, Norm Coleman would say, we have the best healthcare system in the world because we have Mayo Clinic. And it was like, okay, there's no place better to get healthcare than Mayo Clinic in the world, but that's not a healthcare system. We don't have a healthcare system in this country. We didn't have one. If you were in Medicare or Medicaid, you're in the Canadian system. If you're in the VA or in the military, you're in the British system. Socialized medicine. If you're getting from your employer, you're in the German system. If you didn't have insurance, you're in the Cambodian system. And the ACA was about getting people from the Cambodian system into one of the other systems, and either the single payer or the private. And that's what we were doing. And there were some of us who wanted single payer at the time. Bernie Sanders led that, but we needed 60 votes, and we were about 55 votes short. So what we should have been doing, we should be working on, I have a very comprehensive pharmaceutical bill to address the cost of pharmaceuticals. Everybody here knows that the price of pharmaceuticals has shot up in the last 3 years, and there are reasons for that, and we need to address that, and we should be working on that together. We finally got some hearings going on in the HELP committee on that, and we should be addressing, we should have a public option where everybody in every county in the country can get into a public, can get health insurance through a public option.
We have...
Can I have your water?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have time for just one last question. If you could give us a quick answer, if mm-hmm. there can be. How can we save Planned Parenthood?
I think that we have enough... I hope we have enough Republican votes to save that. I know that Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski want to. You know, people don't understand what Planned Parenthood is. They don't understand there isn't a line item in the budget for Planned Parenthood. They don't understand that Planned Parenthood simply gets reimbursed like any other clinic for the services it provides. And it provides... stuff like screenings for cancer, and a lot of women, I think 5 million women or something, get their primary care through Planned Parenthood. And if you won't reimburse Planned Parenthood for these services and Planned Parenthood went under, there would not be enough clinics, and the just the geography of these places where so many women get their care, and this saves lives. This the cancer screenings save lives, and I swear, my colleagues, a number of my colleagues, don't understand that there isn't a lump sum in the budget for Planned Parenthood. The American people need to know it. But I think Planned Parenthood is one of the most popular institutions in the country. So. I think it enjoys, I don't know, 70% approval or something like that. I will fight for Planned Parenthood, and you should too, and you should help us.
Exactly. So I think it appropriate to close this conversation with the final paragraphs from your book.
Okay.
If you wouldn't mind, and just reading that for us.
Okay, because we don't have much time, right?
We don't have too much time.
Okay, so I don't want to. There's a long story that goes into this, and it's about going to a high school graduation in Willmar, Minnesota, which is in south central Minnesota, which is a turkey producing community. Kandiyohi County is the largest turkey producer in Minnesota. Minnesota is the largest turkey producer in the country. And one of our Minnesota Senate pages was from Willmar, and her name's Muna Abdullahi. And Muna is Somali. And I remember when she came, I went to the floor to meet her, and she's easy to pick out. She's Somali. She was wearing a page uniform and a hijab. And I went up to her, and I said, "You look like a Minnesotan." And so I went to the Willmar graduation to introduce her, because she was chosen as a class speaker by the class. And the class had 236 kids in it, and about 60% are your white, Norwegian, Scandinavian, German Minnesotans, and about 15-20% Hispanic, and about 15-10% Somali. And these kids just loved each other. And so I was just talking about how friggin' great it was to be at this commencement and how great this town was. And especially in light of all the hate that Trump was spewing. So I'll put where he put the arrow. Okay. If when you read the book, this book, the Trump presidency has gone in a direction we all fear it might, you might think it's strange for me to have ended this book on a hopeful note. But I'm an optimist, and more importantly, I'm Minnesota's senator. And no matter what happens in the years ahead, no matter who's president, no matter how exciting or depressing our current political environment may be, we who have the honor of serving our state and our country in the Senate always need to remember whom it is we're serving and how fucking great they are. The end. That's it?
No,
we're done?
Yes, stay there.
Okay.
Just stay there. Let's go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right,
so.
Right, no. Save it for the end. Oh, it is the end. Okay. Thank you. Hey, come on, stand up. Oh. Hey, we'll take a bow.
I hope you enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We again thank Senator Al Franken, best-selling author of Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. Our audience here at Santa Clara University, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.